This podcast is driven by Buick Precision, making every road trip a singular experience.
I'm John Ratzenberger. On this Made in America,
we have a hot time in the old town of Cloquet, Minnesota, watching them make fire at the Diamond Match Factory. We drive south to Chicago and hear the heavenly music coming from Lying and Healy harps. Then we blast off from Boulder City, Nevada, and learn why Fisher Space Pens defy gravity. Then we trek up to St. Paul, Minnesota, to see some real life-saving and life-changing technology at Smith's. And finally, we don the rose-colored glasses that put the virtual in reality in American paper optics. A couple of hours north of the Twin Cities, Cloquet, Minnesota sits in the heart of the North Woods along the St. Louis River. The storied history of this paper mill town includes being burnt to the ground in 1918 during one of American history's largest forest fires. Today, Cloquet reflects both its history and some unique cultural touches, like a Frank Lloyd Wright-designed gas station. Yeah, that's right, a gas station. And don't forget the Diamond Match Factory, a fixture here for more than 80 years. 12 billion times a year, people use diamond matches to light fires, stoves, smokes, water heaters, and everything else that needs a flame. It's hard to think of another product that's as useful.
I noticed you got some birch bark. Birch is one of the woods you use?
Birch is one of the woods. This particular species here is aspen. This is the species that we use to make matches.
Aspen is the only one you use to make matches?
Aspen is the only species used.
What's the birch used for?
We use those for other products we manufacture, toothpicks and ice cream sticks and craft items.
Fire hasn't changed since time immemorial, but the science of fire making has. In 1910, 30 years after Diamond was incorporated, the company patented the non-toxic, non-explosive match, an innovation of such life-saving importance that President Taft asked Diamond to donate its patent to the American people, which is just what the company did. Matchmaking at Diamond is an old-fashioned business done the old-fashioned way. Some of the machinery is 100 years old and counting. Dan Glidden is Diamond's president.
No, there's actually two types of matches. One is a strike on the box, which is a safety match, so you have to use the box to light it.
Phosphorus is on the striking surface, and sulfur is on the match. Both are needed to spark a flame. The friction of a strike causes heat, which ignites the sulfur faster than you can say Prometheus.
On a strike anywhere match, they actually put them both on the match. And so you can strike this on any surface where there's friction.
This is called a bull chain, and this is a bull chain operator. And basically what he does is pull the logs and keeps them on at an even pace on this chain, so it feeds the mill. Next place, it goes into the debarker area.
So they're out here doing this in 30 below as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. All year long.
The debarker works pretty much like a pencil sharpener, an incredibly big pencil sharpener. Then the logs are sliced into 25-inch blocks. For the next step, the blocks have to be lifted by hand. Diamond's workers lift more than 2.5 million cubic feet every year. Now the blocks move on to the rotary veneer, where they're peeled like giant carrots into sheets about an eighth of an inch thick.
We load it into the chopper. Basically, what this machine does is it actually makes the match splint out of the veneer. It's a guillotine chopper, and it's just chopping off the right thickness, and it's also chopping the splint to the right length at the same time.
From here, the splints are soaked in a solution of monoammonium phosphate, which prevents afterglow when the burning matchstick is extinguished. The splints are then dried, polished, and placed in thousands of slots.
We orientate the wooden part of the mat so they're all the same direction, and there are fingers that drive that square peg into a round hole on that chain.
It's especially incredible when you consider that they do this to 38 million matches a day. The splints are conveyed into a shaker, which orients them into stacks. And then they're pushed into holes on a conveyor that dips them in the hot wax. The splints become matches once a wet paste of sulfur is applied. It takes about an hour for them to dry in the air. At last, they're ready to be boxed, wrapped, and shipped. When you ask what they do for a living, these people who work at Diamond don't call themselves matchmakers. But maybe they should. After all, nothing heats up emotions or warms the spirits like a good fire. Without it, carrying the torch for someone just wouldn't be the same. Chicago earned the nickname Windy City not for the blustery gusts that blow off Lake Michigan, but for the bluster that blew from politicians. Today, Chicago is known for its tall skyscrapers, great food, harsh winter, and hot jazz. But it's also home to the instrument preferred by 9 out of 10 angels. It's here in Chicago that Lyon and Healy has been making heavenly harps for over 100 years. That's a long time, even for something that's a direct descendant of one of history's oldest musical instruments. With harps, the look is almost as important as the sound, which is why this melodic masterpiece is bathed in pure 23-karat gold. National sales manager Steve Fritzman lets us pull a few strings.
This is all gold?
Yeah, it's a gold leaf, so it's laid, it's all hand-carved wood, and then the gold is all laid and applied over that using clays and gessos under it, and very old world.
Harps as we know them are derived from ancient Egypt nearly 5,000 years ago. Their shape comes from hunter's bows, whose twanging single string probably gave someone an idea to add more strings of different lengths. Over time, more and more of them were added to keep up with the increasingly complex music. Today's harps have 47 strings, as well as a column, a neck, a body, a soundboard, a bass, and 7 pedals to control notes and pitch.
In a way, this is like an upright piano. If you laid this down and played it with keys.
Yeah, it's funny. Some people call it a piano in the nude.
Oh, okay, yeah.
George Lyon and Patrick Healy were young men when they left their Boston homes to head west for the young city of Chicago, where they opened a corner store on Washington and Clark that sold sheet music and instruments. The year, 1864.
The Civil War was still in progress.
Oh, that's right.
And for these guys to set up shop of a very high-end musical instruments in Chicago, they were kind of groundbreaking here.
In 1889, 25 years after opening, they built their first harp and began building their reputation. It grew so that by the 1970s, the company was making nothing but harps. Today it makes 500 a year. But if you're expecting to see an assembly line, forget it. This is strictly an old-fashioned operation, done by the book and hand. Wood is dried in special rooms for up to a year to eliminate moisture that could affect the sound or warp the instrument. Then it's cut into basic shapes that are carved into pieces of art by real artisans.
When you say they're handmade, you're not fooling around.
Yeah, this is something where what we're doing is shaping the body, the sort of the skeleton.
The bodies are made of Sitka spruce and hard maple, which are both resilient and resonant, especially resonant.
This is the nicest part of woodworking.
You really smell the wood,
you can feel the wood.
And
oh, I can feel the high spot.
You've done this before, John.
A couple times.
Yeah.
Next comes the soundboard, considered the heart of the harp.
Here we have a soundboard we're working on.
It vibrates when the strings are plucked, and those vibrations are what give the instrument its voice.
We're just putting a thin coat of shellac on to seal it. We don't want to inhibit the vibration of the soundboard, but we do want to protect it, you know, from moisture loss and moisture gain.
Downstairs, technicians like Xenon piece together the main action, which is the linkage system that connects pedals to strings. With more than 1,400 components packed into 7 layers, it's incredibly complicated.
He's making sure there's going to be enough clearance. There's 14 different linkage systems that go into it in a very small space, so it's very critical, because later on, you don't have the ability to change all that.
Meanwhile, as the innards take shape, master carvers are working to please the eye as much as the music will please the ear. At Chicago's Lyon and Healy Harp Factory, the mechanical workings are coming together, and carvers are giving the columns their intricate designs.
Some beautiful work, Steve.
This is where the carving comes to life here. They really bring all that, all the detail, and sort of add their own little flair to it.
You could have one of these sitting in your living room. You don't necessarily need to know how to play it, but just as a work of art.
Teddy Wichterzak is a master harp maker. No instrument can get past him to the final steps until he's sure that all pieces fit together perfectly.
How long have you been here, Teddy?
24.
24 years. Yeah.
You're
a master art maker.
You're
a
master
art maker.
When I started, I was young, smart, and handsome. Now just handsome.
Beautiful.
What Teddy checks for here is that exquisite balance point.
When they lean it back, we don't want all the weight on the harpist. We want the weight to be balanced right at that plane point. But this is very, very important because this sets the whole alignment.
I'm almost there.
Lyon and Healy's craftsmen go through an active apprentice program. Many take a decade or longer to achieve the designation master. Now that Teddy has signed off, the harp's pieces are sent for finishing. Each of the 53 wooden pieces is given 2 coats of stain and 10 coats of lacquer. And in some cases, they also get the Midas touch.
This is the exciting bit for me here, Steve.
This is a pure gold leaf. It's 23 plus carat. It's the purest form gold can be in.
Oh, I see. Now, I notice you rubbed it against your cheek.
Yeah, that's what picks it up. The static electricity picks it up and allows her to put it down and glues it down. There you go. There's the leaf.
There's the leaf right there. Beautiful.
Take a piece in your hand and just scrunch it in your fingers, and you'll see it'll disappear.
So delicate. It goes to nothing. It's just
It goes to nothing, yeah.
At last, final assembly, where all the pieces come together, from the main action to the strings.
He's working on attaching the pedal rods to the mechanism.
Oh, I see. That's the brains of the outfit.
Yeah, exactly.
It can take up to 6 months to build each harp. 2 months longer if you go for the gold. It's a beauty, that's for sure. But in the harp world, there's a saying, a harp's not a harp until it's been played. Apparently, though, it doesn't matter who does the playing, a ham-fisted wannabe or a consummate artist. Say hello to Sarah Bullen, the Chicago Symphony's principal harpist.
This will make the moment of the harp christening, when I bring it back on your shoulder.
Oh,
now officially you're a harpist. We have 7 foot pedals.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically the black notes of the piano. A lot of musicians like to make harp jokes saying that it's like driving a truck because we're always clonking away with these pedals.
Nice shoes, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much. Harpists are known to have nice shoes because we have to flash them setting our pedals.
All it takes is a little coaching to perform what harpers call a gliss.
That's a good workout, too.
Very good.
Ooh.
Of course, there's gliss, and then there's bliss.
Wonderful.
Do these fold up? Can I take them home?
I recently received a handwritten letter, which is so rare now that I got to thinking about how most of history's greatest writers had to use pens. But what Shakespeare and Keats and Dickens wrote in their own handwriting told us much more about them than just their words. Honestly, I doubt that the Declaration of Independence would have had the same impact or still give us the chills today if Jefferson had merely typed it.
Boulder City, Nevada, 25 miles southeast of Las Vegas. Its population today is 15,000, which is about the number of workers who descended on the area in 1930. They'd come to build what was then America's largest engineering project, Boulder Dam, whose name was later changed to honor Herbert Hoover, the president who'd approved its funding. No, not the Herbert Dam, the Hoover Dam. So Boulder City obviously does big, but it also does small. It's the headquarters of Paul C. Fisher and the Fisher Space Pen Company. Everybody knows that if you build a better mousetrap, the world will come knocking at your door. But what happens when you build a better pen, as Paul Fisher did? Well, apparently your pen gets a free ride into outer space. Born in 1913, Paul Fisher earned a general science degree from Kansas State University. His job during World War II was to help keep our boys aloft by supervising the production of propeller bearings in a Chicago factory. After the war, Paul saw the writing on the wall, which had been written by that new sensation, the ballpoint pen. In 1948, he invented the bullet pen. Though it would soon be successful and considered a design classic, Paul knew it was far from perfect. Like every other pen in the world, the bullet depended on the force of gravity to help it work, so it couldn't write in certain positions. Meanwhile, its flow control could be annoyingly erratic, or worse. The 1960s space race inspired countless Americans, not just NASA scientists, to reach for the skies, at least with their imaginations. Among them was Paul, who in 1965 created the AG-7 anti-gravity space pen, which 3 years later made its first trip into space on the Apollo 7. Before then, astronauts had to write with pencils, because in zero gravity, ordinary pens didn't work, but Fisher's AG-7 did. The reason is that the AG-7's ink begins as a gel that becomes liquid only when the pen's ultra-hard tungsten carbide ballpoint makes contact and begins rolling across the surface. Gravity is optional. Why? Because inside the pen, behind the gel receptacle, is a small cartridge of compressed nitrogen that acts as a kind of engine to ensure the steady flow of ink, whether the pen is in space, underwater, upside down, or just doodling. Reliability is what makes the pen popular with soldiers, policemen, firefighters, mountain climbers, scuba divers, and acrobats. But the AG-7's finest moment may be owed to what it didn't write. July 21st, 1969. Apollo 11 astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin have landed their module and become the first Earthlings on the moon. And on them were the eyes of the world. But what the world didn't know was that after making their small step for man and a giant leap for mankind, the astronauts discovered a serious equipment malfunction that could have proved fatal. A switch on the landing module's engine had broken. No ignition meant no blastoff. So for a while, it looked like the astronauts might be stuck. A nightmare scenario, especially with oxygen running low. For weight's sake, the landing capsule had nothing on board to fix the broken switch. But as the story goes, there was, though, a Fisher AG-7. The astronauts used the pen socket as a tool and were able to manipulate the switch, fire up the engine, and return home. As NASA's John McLeish later told Paul Fisher, the guys might never have made it back without the AG-7. You can't write a better ending than that. Today, at the age of 92, Paul Fisher still leads his company and its 85 employees in a never-ending pursuit of writing excellence. So whether it's in the hands of astronauts, mountain climbers, trivia champs, or trapeze artists, rest assured the Fisher Space Pen has got the right stuff. St. Paul, Minnesota may be known as the twin of Minneapolis, but at best these cities are fraternal, not identical. St. Paul is the hometown of one of America's greatest writers, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and the home of the world's largest stucco snowman. It's also the place where Smith's Medical does nothing less than save lives. Smith's first products in 1983 were computerized infusion pumps for chemotherapy and pain medications. Then in 2002, the company invented the Cosmo, an advanced insulin pump that has dramatically improved the quality of life for millions of diabetics, maybe even someone close to you.
When you're raising a child with diabetes, it's the most important thing is to say, you have this thing called diabetes, it's a pain in the neck, but you can do anything anybody else can do.
At about the weight of a tennis ball and the size of a cell phone, the Cosmo is the most portable mainstream pump. About 21 million Americans of all ages, more than one out of every 14 of us, suffer from diabetes. In simple terms, having type 1 diabetes means that your body has stopped producing the hormone insulin. Insulin helps convert glucose, or blood sugar, into energy by acting as a gatekeeper to the body's cells, unlocking the cells and allowing the sugar to enter. Without insulin, the cells starve, and the body is forced to shut down, and that can be fatal. Since the 1920s, most people with diabetes have controlled the disease by injecting themselves, sometimes several times a day, with insulin. It's both painful and a pain in the you-know-what. That's why they so appreciate self-administering insulin pumps like the Cosmo, because they get to lead far more normal lives, which is, after all, the goal. The Cosmo helps make normality a reality not just by its size, but by its power. Unlike other pumps, it uses regular batteries. A single AAA lasts 3 weeks. The reservoir holds 300 units, 50% more than others, and has a glucose monitor that lets the wearer see when an extra dose might be advised. Obviously, the Cosmo doesn't come out of any ordinary widget factory. Jay Eli is Smith's director of manufacturing.
Basically, what we have is a linear assembly line that's been folded around into a horseshoe.
Everything begins with a subassembly for the chassis that will hold the motor.
Do you mind us breathing down your neck like this?
It's okay.
Nancy's used to it.
You smell good, Nancy. What is that you're wearing?
It's Avon's Amari.
That works.
Next comes the top cover, which includes a liquid crystal display like the one on cell phones.
You see how small it is. The Cosmo has about twice the computing capability as our other older pump does, and yet it's about 20% the size.
How water resistant are these?
You can go swimming with the pump, and by that we mean that you can swim. Scuba diving is not a good idea.
Right. Cosmos are built from the top down. Top first, bottom next.
Building the lower assembly is kind of like making a sandwich, John. We start with the bottom, we work our way to the top.
Now the cartridge that will hold the insulin is inserted. It will be monitored by laser diodes.
It's kind of like the safety system in your garage door. You got a light beam going across.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's how we detect the presence of a cartridge in here.
What do you do here, Kathy?
What I'm doing is I'm sealing up the pump. I am sealing the battery compartment and the bolus button so it doesn't leak when you go under the water.
A bolus is an extra insulin dose needed to cover a spike in blood sugar. Whenever necessary, Cosmo users have only to hit the bolus button. That's a big comfort.
So it's the regulator. It's like the gas pedal.
If you want to go a little bit faster, you hit the bolus button. It gives you a little bit more insulin. Like if you eat a donut, you know, I gotta give a little bit more insulin for
take care of that.
Now the Cosmo's internal components are ready to assume their places.
At this station is where we assemble the drivetrain, and a fair amount of actual assembly takes place at this step.
It's the dental station, I see. You've got the dental tools here.
Our pump is extremely small, and the components are very, very small. And so we handle it with tweezers and precision drivers. They're set up to deliver a specified amount of torque to the fasteners.
A device called an infusion set connects the pump to a tube implanted beneath the skin, usually in the stomach. Of course, every body needs a brain. So a computer helps the user calculate his blood sugar level and offers gentle suggestions of how much insulin is needed and when. Sam Tinjum installs the boards which do all the thinking for the pump.
I always look at these as though you're flying over a city. Doesn't that look like an airport to you?
Yeah, it does. Huh?
Installing the computer is delicate work. Any amount of static electricity can destroy it. At last, the two halves are joined to make a whole Cosmo. Naturally, they have to be hermetically sealed to ensure that nothing ever interferes with the pump's operation, even if the user goes swimming.
We just put it into the fixture. And this lets us know if it's leak-proof.
We measure the amount of air that surrounds the pump. If that pressure goes down, then we know that the air is leaked into the pump.
Look at that.
Now the software is downloaded into the Cosmo, as if getting a prescription filled.
After we've built our pump, and we've tested our pump, and we've programmed our pump, is to run it through some final functional tests and then package it.
You can admire the genius of the Cosmo all day and night, but to get a palpable appreciation for the joy it brings, you just have to meet some of its users, like my friend, Heidi Rosati.
How long have you been wearing it?
4 happy years.
4 years. Really yep. Freed you up, huh?
Oh, my gosh. It's a new world. It's a whole new world. And I no longer have to have my diabetes control me. I control my diabetes.
Aaron Mastonen and Thomas Atchison also use the Cosmo.
How long have you been wearing yours, Thomas?
About 6 months.
Can we see it?
Yeah.
For say you have a slice of bread, how do you calculate how much glucose that's going to be in your blood system?
Well, a slice of bread is typically 18 grams of carbohydrates. So you dial in 18 grams into your insulin pump, and you've programmed your pump for the insulin to carb ratio, and it calculates out how many units of insulin to give you.
So the pump does the figuring for you.
Pump does the thinking, John. That's the greatest part about it.
For Heidi, Aaron, and Thomas, the people at this plant who make their Cosmos are truly lifesavers.
When I see this happen, I just want to hug each and every one of these people because they're making us work. Before, it was 4 or 5 shots a day. Now I just wear a pump.
I'll guarantee you, when you guys walk away, there won't be a dry eye out on this line. They're all going to be crying.
And there probably won't be a dry eye in the parking lot.
Girls.
To do well and to do good. What could be better than that?
At the dawn of television, when millions of people began tuning in at home, they also began tuning out at local movie houses. So studios thought they'd better come up with gimmicks to keep selling tickets, like 3D as in three-dimensional. By putting on a pair of special goofy glasses, you were supposed to feel like you were actually in the movie, not just watching it. Well, 3D has come a long way since then. Let's see whether the glasses have, too.
Whether it came from beyond beyond, or below below, or even a gruesome art museum. In the 1950s, monsters were supposed to be bigger than life and jump right out of the screen. Yes, it was the heyday of illusion, when millions of people didn't mind looking silly in order to experience not just height and width, but also the third dimension, depth. Your naked eyes gave you the first two, but only 3D glasses could give you the third. Alas, alack, that era has passed, or has it? Apparently, the demand for 3D specs has never really gone away.
American Paper Optics, how may I direct your call? Sure, I'll be glad to...
One of the world's leading manufacturers of the glasses is American Paper Optics. And as the name says, they're made right here, in Memphis, actually. Home of the booze, great food, and of course, Graceland. APO's business, it seems, needs as much humor as business sense. And founder John Jarrett doesn't lack for either. The company's success is no illusion. It began in 1990 when Jarrett sold 3D fireworks glasses for the 4th of July. Soon, demand grew for other varieties, and APO grew along with it. In all, the company has produced 700 million pairs, an average of almost 50 million a year. That includes holiday season glasses, which transform ordinary Christmas tree lights into dancing snowmen, twinkling snowflakes, or something even more stirring. The effect comes to your brain courtesy of APO's exclusive lenses, which are sometimes used for more than just fun. Some eye doctors, for example, bring out 3D glasses to test, what else, depth perception. And NASA uses them to view images from Mars. Meanwhile, skywatchers put on super dark lenses in order to look directly at solar eclipses. Most of APO's glasses, however, are made and used for customized promotions. Most 3D lenses work by filtering out certain colors, with each lens assigned to different ones. Just as people with only one good eye lack depth perception, A person with two good eyes, who now sees the same two-dimensional image from slightly altered perspectives, observes depth that isn't really there. In this case, it is nice to fool Mother Nature. Obviously, this is real science in the service of play, and there's no playing around with the science. The filtering film is cut to exacting measurements, and the designs printed on cardboard sheets. Then comes mass production. The eye holes are punched out, and the front and back sheets are glued to the lenses. Finally, the 3D glasses reach the fourth D. Done. The sheer variety of designs is mind-boggling. But of course, here at APO, that's somehow only fitting.
Thank you very much.
See you down the road on Made in America.